Now, we live, of course, at a time when billions of people have access to unbelievably powerful technology, either in your pocket or in your bag or whatever. We're talking about your smartphone. And a man who knows his stuff, the BBC's tech man, Rory Catalan-Jones, has written a new book about it called Always On. I'm delighted to welcome Rory to the show. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you, sir. Been wanting to get you on for a while. I'm fascinated by the job you do. What a great job. As a tech man myself, you've got the best job in the world, Rory.
That's very kind of you to say so. Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it for quite some time. I actually got the title in January 2007, which turned out to be a great time to start doing tech full time, because just about the first story I covered was the launch of the iPhone. I was there in the hall in San Francisco when Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone, and that was basically the beginning of the smartphone era.
Absolutely brilliant. And what's your background, Rory? Were you a kind of techie guy before, or why were you so fascinated by the subject matter?
The sad truth is that I am the least techie guy.
I'm very old.
When I was at school, there was one computer at school in the physics block, and only people doing physics could go near it, and you had to wear a white coat. And I didn't do scientific subjects, and I got fascinated by all this. I was a business correspondent in the mid 90s. All the interesting companies were the up and coming dot-com businesses, the Netscapes. I don't know if anybody remembers Netscapes. And then, of course, Google. And then we had this extraordinary dot-com bubble, and I started covering that as a business reporter. Wow. And was just fascinated by, you know, the energy in that world and the realization about what the internet in particular was going to do to all of us. And I kind of latched onto that and ran with it. And, you know, I have to run fast to keep up on the technology, because, you know, I don't have a technology background, but, you know, I've learned to do a bit of coding. I try and immerse myself in it. I try to talk to the best possible people.
Good for you. We were just reminiscing, myself and David did the breakfast show, about old computers. And I remember the Sinclair Spectrum and the ZX81 really well, you know, and their cassette tapes where you loaded a program on. It took about 10 minutes for the thing to appear. Then it was rubbish anyway. How far we have come, Rory, eh?
Absolutely. Well, when you look at, what's incredible about it is we've become very quickly blasé.
Yeah.
The fact that we are carrying around these extraordinarily powerful computers, obviously much more powerful than the ones that, you know, powered Apollo 11 to the moon, for example.
Yes.
And they can do these extraordinary things. Artificial intelligence built into them. That's extraordinary. The fact that you can talk to your phone and it will understand what you're saying.
Yep.
And now we just get irritated when it doesn't understand us properly. And think, well, that's rubbish. But actually, it's a bit of a miracle.
It is. And of course, with all these benefits come downsides. And that's kind of what you talk about, really, in the book. I mean, it's the power in our pocket and it's always on. But there's a lot of downsides to this. And you know a lot of people and have talked to them, you know, at the forefront of this revolution, the Elon Musks, the Tim Berners-Lees, the Stephen Hawkings. Elon Musk, an interesting character, you know, as we look up in the sky, we see his satellites blocking out our view. And I heard this morning they've just appointed a couple of people in Spain to take the Starlink satellite system, which is an extraordinary thing when you think about it, you know, the technology. But Elon Musk, interesting man. I think you've got your views on him, haven't you?
I've got a whole chapter on Elon Musk, who is a fascinating guy. And I say at the beginning of the chapter that, you know, halfway through the smartphone era, you could be disappointed in it. There's a great quote from Peter Thiel, who's a slightly controversial figure, saying, "We were promised flying cars. We got 140 characters, i.e. the original length of a tweet." But then Elon Musk came along, and he was the guy who quite literally promised us flying cars, promised that we'd become a multi-planet species. And I went and did a big interview with him in 2016. I drove in a Tesla from Las Vegas to his design center in Los Angeles.
Wow.
Slightly scared about the autopilot system, which at one stage decided to take us off in our Tesla, which decided to take us off the road.
Goodness.
But there again. And I'd been building up to this interview for 3 months because it'd been a long time in the negotiation.
Sure.
And when I sat down at first, I thought, this is not going to work. He's a bit hesitant. And then he suddenly said a number of extraordinary things, including, "When we're a multi-planet species."
Oh.
And I thought, yeah, this is going to be okay.
Wow.
But I ended up writing something afterwards, in which I described him as bonkers but brilliant.
Yes.
And that didn't go down too well with his PR guy. He said it was disrespectful. And I tried to explain that bonkers in England
is fairly affectionate.
Term of affection.
Yes.
Didn't wash. And he's gone on just continually veer between the brilliant and the bonkers. And, you know, we've all seen his slightly crazed behavior on Twitter.
Yeah.
And his obsession with cryptocurrencies, about which I've got a particular downer.
Yeah.
Combined with him continuing to revolutionize the car industry and do these extraordinary things in space.
Goodness me. I hope one of those Starlink satellites isn't following you around then, Rory. Blimey, I'd be worried if I was you. So let's talk about the upsides. I mean, there are many, many upsides of this. It's happened so fast that a lot of people have been bewildered by it, to be honest. And as you say, we kind of take it for granted, the power in our pocket now. But there really are a lot of advantages, aren't there, in what's happened?
Yeah, I mean, my book takes a sort of story arc where the first section of it is really upbeat, and then we go down into the slough of despond, as it were, about all the bad sides of social media. But it ends with a whole section because the pandemic happened while I was writing it.
Mm.
And the pandemic brought into focus both the good and the bad. I imagine at one stage in the book, what would have happened if the pandemic had come along in 2005? How much more difficult it would have been to live our lives, to work,
sure.
For example. I mean, here I am in my loft in West London, where I've been for the last year. I do a weekly radio program from here. I do TV from here. I do all sorts from here.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have been possible back in 2005. Every morning and evening, I've got a granddaughter, age two, the other side of London, who we just can't get to see. I see her on FaceTime.
Yes.
Think of all the kids who've had, you know, remote learning has not been great, but there would have been none of that before the age of the smartphone, really, and the great connectivity that's brought us, and the great connections the great sort of access to information that has brought us.
Absolutely, and here we are having this conversation on a day that the big news of the day is the government's online safety bill announced in the Queen's speech, which is all about harmful content in social media and for people like your granddaughter. You know, this is a massively important thing that they're talking about here with this draft legislation, and that's one of the major downsides of all of this, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a chapter near the end about the irony about the way in the early stages of the pandemic this ridiculous conspiracy theory arose that the coronavirus was linked to 5G.
Yes.
And people, the other irony is people spreading these rumors and spreading complete nonsense about things like 5G and vaccinations, of course, using this very high-powered technology that connects people so fast.
Mm.
So that is one major worry. The other major worry, of course, is that we back in 2007, the power was a bit more evenly distributed. You had Nokia, the Finnish company, being the biggest noise in mobile phones. You had Canada's BlackBerry, you had the likes of Sony Ericsson. And then very quickly, it all became, certainly in the West, about the giants on the West Coast, the Amazons, the Apples, the Facebooks, the Googles, and the Microsofts, and their power has become a matter of increasing concern. That's, of course, part of what the government's trying to do with this slightly unwieldy online safety bill, which will give the regulator Ofcom extraordinary powers, but may give it, you know, an unenviable job, really, in deciding what should be allowed and what shouldn't be allowed.
Absolutely. And the power in our pocket has kind of infiltrated all of our lives, and a lot of people have come to trust it, and that's part of the problem as well, which you talk about in the book about scams. And I see that Priti Patel yesterday said that the scam provisions in this bill would help fight ruthless criminals who defraud millions of people. Well, they've got a bit of a fight on their hands there, because frankly, it's a bit out of control. And I've taken recently, you've probably seen them yourselves, to scam baiters who these brilliant guys who tend to be in America,
yes,
who will just take on these call centers in India and wind them up with their own scams.
There's a great guy in, I think he's based in Northern Ireland, who does this, who actually takes over their computers.
Yes.
Effectively puts a webcam into Brilliant. Their computer and Brilliant. Secretly films them. Yeah, that's very interesting. I've got a bit of a hobby myself because I get so many of these scam calls, and I have recorded them in the past, kept them on the phone for 30 minutes telling me that my PC is wrong.
Oh, yes, yes,
and
yes.
And then 30 minutes in saying, actually, I've got a Mac, yes. being told I'm wasting their time.
Yeah, they get quite grumpy, but of course the downside of that is it tends to be elderly people who are maybe alone who will get this call saying, you know, your computer's broken, your Windows needs fixed, or your Amazon account's a bit dodgy, or whatever, whatever. But they get taken in by that, and they're seriously taken for a huge financial ride, aren't they?
I know. Tell me about it. I've got an elderly relative who was indeed taken for a ride exactly that way a few years back, and the bank eventually stopped the biggest payment going through. But,
goodness.
But it is... some of it seems amusing. It's very unfunny when it's vulnerable elderly people who struggle quite understandably yeah. with this technology.
Absolutely.
And can be easily fooled into doing things that they shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And some of it is very convincing.
Absolutely. Well,
but I mean, I'm not sure that's an argument against the technology.
Sure.
There have always been scams
sure.
and there's always been criminals, and they will find whatever's available to them.
Absolutely right. But it does, of course, then bring us back to that whole social media and the onus being on those colossal companies who are making billions and billions of pounds with our data, effectively. And that's what we're trusting them with, isn't it? And we remember the Cambridge Analytica scandal back in 2016, and Facebook had sold data from 50 million users. These firms really need to be a bit more responsible with the data that we are trusting them with.
Well, yeah, there's a great, fascinating battle going on right now over that between Apple and Facebook. Apple very much painting itself as the good guys.
Yes.
And you can question about that with this new change to their operating system on their phones, which stops, which makes it easier to turn down the tracking
yes.
on which the likes of Facebook depend, and that's causing a big row.
Yep.
I mean, we are getting more control over our phones, but it takes quite a bit of work. You usually have to drill down into the settings and understand quite deeply what's going on. I suppose the other question is, you know, some people will care deeply that they're being tracked. Others may feel, well, I'd rather have adverts that were relevant to me than were not. But it's a question, actually, I think it comes down to of choice, being given that, at least you're these days more likely to be given the choice of whether you want to be tracked or not.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the benefits, of course, of technology is that it can help us very much in the world of health. We have a whole chapter, in fact, on the COVID tracing app, which was an interesting story in itself. But, you know, you yourself have a very personal foot in this because of the way that technology yeah. has affected your Parkinson's prognosis. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, one interesting thing, the book starts with a sort of prologue of a day back in 2019 when I was covering the launch of 5G, doing a broadcast over 5G, and afterwards a producer who knew I'd just been diagnosed with Parkinson's asked whether I'd considered going public because it was becoming very evident on air that my hand was shaking. And there I got the good side of social media because I tweeted about it and got a fantastic response.
And yes.
Apart from one guy who said you've been standing too close to 5G phone masts, everybody else was sympathetic. But that also set me off kind of wondering about what technology can do. And I've been involved in several sort of trials, really. I was involved in a trial last week, which involves strapping on sensors, doing some exercises in front of what is effectively a Zoom call with a researcher, and sending data back to them. Because what they're trying to do with Parkinson's is find a better way of first diagnosing it and then measuring the symptoms. Because it's
right.
it's very much kind of doctor going, yeah, you seem to be limping a bit. It's not very precise. And they feel that if they can get a ton more data and use sort of machine learning techniques, they can possibly come up with apps that measure it, that can diagnose it, that can, you know, advise you on how much medication you take, and so on and so forth. It's quite an early stage, this research, but it's a lot of interesting work going on.
How interesting. The world of health and technology is an interesting, polarizing one, and particularly now more than ever, I guess, when there is talk of digital vaccine passports for travel and all the rest of it. Some people are maybe rightly skeptical that health data in the hands of people who before have proven that they can't be trusted is maybe not a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge debate about the contact tracing app. There are two ways of seeing this. And there was a lot of concern that by privacy campaigners that people were using one of these apps would be giving away too much data about their location. Their arguments kind of won, and you could say that the app that came out was so private that it didn't actually tell the authorities an awful lot about what was going on. You never knew who had been, you know, registered as in proximity to the disease, so you couldn't tell them. Well, you could tell them to isolate with a phone notification, but, you know, people would tend to ignore that.
Yeah.
So that's the other argument. There's a balance there, and people looked at different parts of the world who had a very different approach. I mean, South Korea, I had a close look at that, took all sorts of data and mapped it very precisely, you know, every bit of credit card data, every bit of CCTV, to map people's movements to do the contact tracing.
Yes.
And that was quite successful. But would we be willing to accept that level of surveillance? Probably not.
And then you could take, I guess, that to its logical extent. You take China, who are so far in, advanced on that particular train that, you know, that they follow you everywhere, and they can facially recognize you wherever you are.
Yeah, facial recognition is becoming a big sort of area of controversy anywhere. But it's one area of artificial intelligence where, you know, China in its battle with the US is probably ahead, has perfected it and is using it in ways which would make all of us, should make all of us, feel pretty uncomfortable.
Absolutely. And as a man who talks to tech giants all the time and looks at the trends out there, what's your view on, you know, your smartphone being your cash in the future, which is very much the way that it's going right
now? Well, what's funny about that is that has been talked about for so long. It is happening now. I mean, I pay most of the time with my smartphone.
Right.
But the interesting thing is it started with something called M-Pesa, which was a system in Kenya and a couple of other African countries with a very sort of simple system where you could send money basically in the form of a text message. And they advanced on that front long before lots of other countries. I mean, the United States has been very slow in all sorts of ways about money, about automating money. You still get checks flying around, I think, in the United States. So, yeah, that revolution is definitely happening and, you know, gathering pace.
Well, it's all there and more in the book, Rory. The book is called Always On. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today. And if you're ever considering a retirement, give us a shout, will you? So I can put in the application early to the BBC.
I'll let you know.
I think that's what they said to me the last time I asked, to be honest with you. Rory, all the best. You take care of yourself. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.